You are listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss.
Step by step along this march, Candy One, Candy One. Many stones can form an arch, singly done.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions and is sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at UMKC. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. Tonight's show is being underwritten by United Auto Workers Local 31 and Teamsters Local 41. Buy American. Keep America working. United Auto Workers Local 31. We build the Chevy Malibu and the Buick LaCrosse at the GM Fairfax plant. What you drive, drives America. And Teamsters Local 41 is the largest Teamster local in Kansas City and the surrounding area and represents approximately 6,000 members in many industries, including freight, UPS, dairy, food and beverage, bakery, warehouse, car haul, car dealers, car rental, parking and show work. We help workers and their families achieve and live the American dream. Our members are hardworking, patriotic, caring, family-oriented, and civic-minded, and we proudly support our men and women in uniform that put their lives on the line every day to protect our rights and freedom. And we thank our underwriters for their support to the Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI. On tonight's show, sheet metal workers and Sierra Club team up to demand Missouri move towards energy efficiency. John Hickey of the Sierra Club says, Missourians are paying too much on our monthly energy bills. We're putting additional air pollution in the air. We have high unemployment and in the construction sector. He and Steve Sneed from the sheet metal workers, Local 36, want us to invest more in energy efficiency because that means jobs. And what about auto bargaining? Will two-tier really be phased out? Why did GM Skilled Trades vote down the contract? What's happening at Ford? Find out all of that on tonight's show. In the news, Tuesday's fast food worker strike also included daycare workers. And pensions become a huge issue for the Teamsters and maybe the rest of us. Our feature at the end of the show is a new one, Remember Our Struggle with Ariana Eagle. It's a new feature by a new volunteer. Ariana is an apprentice with IBEW Local 124. Now for the news.
This is the news from our side. On Tuesday, Kansas City was one of over 500 cities to go out on the biggest strike day ever for $15 and a union. In this, the eighth strike in Kansas City, about 300 workers and supporters took 12th Street and marched several blocks down the middle of the street from Barney Ellis Plaza to City Hall. Miraculously, no one got arrested. The message was, of course, $15 and a union, but this strike also highlighted the upcoming elections in 2016 and told candidates we're watching to see if they support low-wage workers. Stand Up KC also said we're watching what they say about immigration reform because many low-wage workers are immigrants, and they need justice too. Black Lives Matter activists also spoke out to support fixing a broken political system that doesn't meet the needs of working families, especially families of color in our community. At noon, workers and allies from Jobs with Justice and faith groups rallied at the child care and home care facilities to show our solidarity with all low-wage working people. They said, these are the dedicated folks that care for our children and loved ones, and they shouldn't live in poverty.
The Atlantic reports child care is really expensive. In some states, the costs can top 15% of the median income for a married couple. And when looking at single-family households, that burden can easily pass 40% of the median income. One place all that money is not going is the pockets of the workers doing all that child care. A new study released by the Economic Policy Institute found that, on average, these women, and it's almost entirely women, are paid significantly less than the average American worker and are twice as likely to live in poverty. The median hourly wage for child care workers in the United States is $10.39, which is nearly 40% below the median hourly wage of workers in other occupations. Even when you account for gender, minority status, and education, child care workers are still earning 23% less than other occupations. One of the strikers on Tuesday confirmed all of that, and she's Kimmy DeVries, and here is the interview that Judy Ansel did with her.
I work at a YMCA Head Start. I'm a teacher assistant, and I've been there for 3 years.
And they say that child care workers for the first time joined the action today. Did any of them strike?
No, none of us strike today. We were out in, most of us were at our job sites, but standing in solidarity with people striking today.
Okay, and are you also demanding 15 in a union?
Yes, we are working for union rights and $15 an hour.
What do child care workers make now?
It totally depends on the center. Kenya, another woman speaking, makes $7.75. I make $10.32. At my center, some people make $9. Some people do make closer to $15, but we're all pretty much low-wage workers.
Do you get any benefits?
I do have health insurance through my job, but I have to pay for it, and it's about $120 a month for a fairly basic plan, and it's supposed to go up next year.
Yeah. What are the main issues for the child care workers? Is it the money?
A lot of it is the money. It's really hard to be a great teacher when you're also living in poverty and dealing with that stress in your own life. How do you come to work and support kids' child development when you're not sure if your lights are going to be on at home or if you're going to have gas or if you're going to have a home? And I went to Washington, D.C. last week and met with child care workers from all over the country, and the stories are the same everywhere we go.
Are there other people where you work who are supporting this today?
Yes, I saw 3 other coworkers from my center out today.
That's great. That must have made you feel good, no?
It sure did.
So how'd you feel about this whole thing today?
I spoke at Ubuntu Village at 12 o'clock today.
What did you say?
I talked about my story of how I make $10.32 an hour and I can't pay my phone bill without my parents' help. I struggle to pay for my medical care, and I have $90,000 in student loans that's extremely difficult to figure out how to deal with, and it makes me just feel anxiety all the time thinking about that debt.
The Missouri-Kansas City Committee to Protect Pensions is blowing the whistle on pension cuts. The looming Central States pension cuts will wreck families and communities in this area as retired Teamsters are facing cuts of 50 to 65% and more of their earned pension incomes. We want journalists, politicians, small business owners, clergy, social service agencies, and the public to hear our stories. Our fight today will be your fight tomorrow as the disappearance of the middle class in America continues. We're asking people to bring their whistles and signs to join them at a rally called Blowing the Whistle on Pension Cuts. They're taking the rally to the Kansas City Star Building, reasoning that if the star doesn't come to them, we will go to the star. It's 1729 Grand Avenue, Kansas City, Mo, at noon, Thursday, November 19th. Retirees, bring a copy of your pension cuts letter from the Central States Pension Fund, and a letter of harm that will be caused if these cuts are incurred by your family. The news tonight was read by Molly Madden, Beth Pike, and yours truly, Michael Savoy.
Climate change may generate floods, drought, and disease, disasters that could bring us to our knees. But must we be so negative, afraid the fry or freeze? We've got sweet aerosol sprays and stylish SUVs.
Stylish SUVs!
Though there may be just a little too much sunshine all over the earth someday. If there's just a little too much sunshine, we'll all have to move away. Let's be zen-like as we stand at the precipice, creatively combating this global menace. Why not make the North Pole a hot spot for tennis? Put gondolas on New York streets. It worked in Venice.
Worked in Venice!
Though there may be just a little too much sunshine all over the earth someday. If there's just a little too much sunshine, we'll all have to move away. Studies say since 1750 our actions have caused the earth to warm. All those years and the planet's not dead yet. Maybe this is something we can just forget. Corporate moguls sometimes find laws they must evade, environmental roadblocks to free trade. It may be true Earth's atmosphere has somewhat decayed, but glitches can occur while there are billions being made.
Billions being made!
Though there may be just a little too much sunshine all over the earth someday. If there's just a little too much sunshine, we'll all have to move away. There may be just a little too much sunshine all over the earth someday. If there's just a little too much sunshine, we'll all have to move away.
Hi, this is Judy Ansel. On October 23rd, the American Council for Energy Efficient Economy ranked Missouri 44th worst in the nation for energy efficiency. John Hickey, director of the Missouri Sierra Club, reacted to the news by saying, "Missourians are paying too much on our monthly energy bills. We're putting additional air pollution on the air. We have high unemployment in the construction sector." Steve Sneed, director of education for the Sheet Metal Workers Union in St. Louis, said in response to the study, "It's frustrating to see other states make energy efficiency gains and save money while Missouri continues to lag behind." So, what's the matter with Missouri anyway? It seems the only folks benefiting from this situation would be the energy providers, coal and gas companies, and maybe the respiratory illness doctors. Why can't Missouri do better? Well, we'll find out if they can from John Hickey and Steve Sneed, two labor environmental partners. Welcome to the show, both of you. Are you there, Steve?
I am.
Great. And John, can you hear us?
Yeah, thanks for having us on, Judy.
Okay, great. We had a few technical problems with our phones, and so I'm really glad to have you both here. So the American Council for an Energy Efficient Economy, otherwise known as ACEEE, issued its report card, as they do every year, which put Missouri in 44th place out of 50. We should note that Kansas was just behind Missouri at 45th.
So how do they measure this? John, you want to answer that?
Sure. The ACEEE looks at a variety of policy issues. For example, it looks at building codes. What is the residential and commercial building code? How much money are utilities investing in energy efficiency programs? Are there combined heat and power units that are in operation to make energy use more efficient? So it's seven different areas that collectively are worth 50 points, and then each state is evaluated on these seven different measures, given the number of points based on its performance in that area, and that number is what sets you in the list between 1 and 50.
Uh-huh. Okay. So why is it that Missouri is so backward in this area?
Well, in Missouri, utility companies until recently put very little money into energy efficiency. The utility companies made more money by getting you to buy more electricity, even if you were buying more electricity because you had wasteful, outdated appliances, outdated lighting systems, poor insulation, out-of-date furnaces, etc. And so that is one of the key factors. And while some utilities, including Kansas City Power and Light, I would add, now do have energy efficiency programs, so we're starting, still many municipalities and electric co-ops and other electricity sales groups in Missouri do not have robust energy efficiency programs. And that's a key factor, and that's one of the things that, as a Sierra Club, we've really been pushing Kansas City Power and Light and other utilities to invest in efficiency because it saves customers money, number one, but number two, it creates local jobs because think about it. You can't outsource insulating a ceiling, or you can't outsource rerunning efficient duct work in your HVAC system. That's going to create jobs right here at home, and so it's a good example of something that's good for the environment, but good for local employment as well.
Okay, let me ask you, Steve, because I bet you're really on top of all these technical issues. What are the best ways to become more energy efficient?
You need to have your systems checked out. If we weren't talking about local homeowners, to have a clean and check done on your systems periodically every year, and your the tech that comes in. We do have techs across the country in different locals. I'm sure we have some in Kansas City. I know in St. Louis we do, and they'll let you know if there's something more available. If your home has got, if you spend the money on your windows and you're insulating and you're weatherproofing your home, and your furnace is from 1958, which my mother's was. They'll come in and say, you could really, a Lennox or whatever brand they're selling. All of our manufacturers that we put in have got high efficiency stuff, but it doesn't pay to put the high efficiency stuff in if your home isn't up to date with the new windows and stuff. And that's the best way to do it, is just have somebody come in and look at it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Is this work that the sheet metal workers do?
It is. We do a lot of training on it. There's a lot of different options out there nowadays. There's geothermal stuff that's hit the market. We've been training with geothermal since 2005 or 6. Local 36 has our international, any of the international, any of the locals in St. Louis and across the country can get the training. Our international produces all that material for us to train on. Our school, our particular school, we got geothermal. Our building is a LEED Platinum building, and so we've got a lot of the high-end systems in our disposal to train with our membership.
Okay, and so you guys make the argument, and probably this is a question for you again, Steve. You guys make the argument that it creates more jobs by investing in energy efficiency than leaving it the way it is, and why is that?
Kansas City, just like St. Louis, our buildings and our infrastructure in both our cities is very aging. The systems that are in these older buildings that are downtown, and others use that as an example, are, you know, pretty old. A lot of the new technology calls for a lot more fresh air into the buildings. Monitors CO2 that people, you know, your average people, like in my school, for instance, in my classrooms and throughout, we've got CO2 sensors in our classrooms that as the as we have more students in the room, there's more CO2 being put out just by us folks breathing. And so the system will ramp up and take care of putting more fresh air into the classrooms and ramp up the system. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what we need in these older buildings. If the owners had, you know, an opportunity to save some money by updating these systems, and I think the general public would be a lot more healthier. That's what we're seeing anyway.
Interesting.
It is. Real interesting.
How many jobs do you think could be created this way? Do you have any kind of estimate?
Oh, I would, you know, it's really hard to put a figure on it, because if it all happened at one time, you know, you're looking at maybe a couple hundred, maybe, you know, all one, you know, in the city of St. Louis, but it's across the board, you know, it would even reflect out further than just the local 36 members, because you got the energy audit people. We teach energy auditing too, but you may have an energy audit company come in who's an engineering firm and tell you what you need for your systems, and that's jobs there. You've got the folks coming in doing the, you know, the tear out, which is possibly my folks, but maybe another organization. So it's kind of just keeps, you know, folding down with folks working.
Uh-huh. Okay. Well, John, of course we live in an age of climate change, and there's all sorts of disastrous things happening. Is the alternative to becoming more energy efficient also disastrous as far as climate change is concerned? You know, what are the costs of not doing this?
Well, there's two ways to look at the costs of inaction. The first is, right now, a big chunk of downtown Kansas City has been designated by the Environmental Protection Agency as having unsafe levels of sulfur dioxide in the air, because of pollution from burning coal at the Veolia plant, which is in downtown Kansas City by the river.
Mm.
And so 65,000 Kansas City residents every day are breathing air that causes asthma attacks, stroke, and heart attack because of that dirty air. And Kansas City's got some of the worst asthma rates in the whole state of Missouri. Mm. So our elderly and our children are already paying a price. In the long haul, we also have to worry about carbon pollution, because that drives climate change. And if you look at the best ways to reduce carbon pollution in Missouri, energy efficiency is the top, because it's the cheapest, it's cheaper than coal, it's also cheaper than wind and solar, and it's cleaner than all those options, and it also creates local jobs. So as we look at how do we deal with our long-term carbon pollution problem, the energy efficiency is going to be our main tactic to solve it, and that's why we got to get it right.
Okay. So you mentioned something called the EPA's Clean Power Plan. Is that a plan to eliminate coal power plants, or what is it?
The Clean Power Plan would reduce carbon pollution in the state of Missouri by 2030. It would reduce it by 32% compared to the 2005 baseline. So it's not eliminating carbon pollution, but it would cut it by about a third. And so that's a good start. And what it would do is it would set a limit on how much carbon pollution we could put in the air, just like we already have limits on how much mercury or sulfur dioxide or other sorts of air pollutants you can put in the air.
Is there no standard right now for how much carbon pollution you can put in the air?
There's no standard at all. You could put as much carbon into the air as you want every day, and there's no limit whatsoever.
That's actually amazing. You know, for somebody who doesn't know a whole bunch about environmental stuff, that shocks me that in this day and age when we're all talking about greenhouse gases and carbon and all that stuff, that there's no standard. So, exactly.
That's why it's, you know, thank God for President Obama and the EPA to finally step up to the plate and deal with this pollutant and really use the Clean Air Act, which was passed in 1970. This is not right. new news. This is a law passed in 1970 that here, almost 50 years later, we're finally applying.
So would this plan actually shut down the Veolia plant that you talked about?
Veolia is not an electric generating plant. It's a combined heat and power plant. So it's not covered by the Clean Power Plan, but Veolia will still have to quit burning coal because of sulfur dioxide. Sulfur dioxide is a pollutant. It's been regulated under the Clean Air Act for many years, and because of that, Veolia's got to clean up its act, and we're hoping they clean it up as soon as possible.
So how much of Missouri's electric power is coming from coal currently?
Well, that's a great question. Almost 80% of Missouri's electricity today comes from coal, but if you just go a few blocks away from the studio and you go to Kansas, in Kansas, 15% of the electricity comes from wind. Missouri gets about 1% from wind.
Huh.
So, and last time I was in Kansas City, people on the other side of the state line didn't seem that much faster or smarter or harder working than people on our side of the state line.
Well, you're talking to somebody 15%. Who lives in Kansas here, so watch it.
And if you go to north instead of west, and you go to Iowa, Iowa gets over 25% of its electricity from wind. So if anybody who's listening has driven to Chicago recently, and you drive up Highway 55. You see all sorts of wind farms as you pass through Joliet and that area. So Missouri's kind of we're an outlier. The rest of the Midwest is really getting it, both with wind energy and with energy efficiency, and we're lagging behind there in number 44.
So how did Kansas end up below Missouri in energy efficiency then?
Well, they're better on wind, but they're not better on energy efficiency. Because the ACEEE scorecard looks at how efficiently you use what you've got, not how you generate it.
Okay. So, Steve, back to you. Obviously, the Sheet Metal Workers Union is a construction union, and I think construction unions have this image that they're not exactly on board with environmentally sound things. I guess that's because of the Keystone XL pipeline. So how'd you get into all this stuff?
As sheet metal workers, when you look at the energy efficiency side of a type of scorecard, we do quite a bit of it. The tab work, the testing and balancing. Once these systems are installed, the sheet metal workers go in and make sure the system's operating to what it's spec'd out to be. There's always books put out, and so our guys go in and make sure that the systems are operating up to its potential. The ductwork that's installed has got to be designed and fabricated and input in per specification. It's tested, and we have been on the cutting edge of all that stuff for many, many years. I know when John and I were talking about this, I went back and looked at some of the curriculum that has been developed over the years. And our international has been putting, that I know of, and there's probably more than this, some other guys could probably talk better, that energy management was put out in 1983.
Wow.
So they went out and had a need, our contractor association, which is called SMAC, the Sheet Metal Air Conditioning Contractors Association.
Mm-hmm.
We work hand-in-hand with our contractors, and as new equipment comes out, new processes and stuff, and they're needing it, then they get with us, and our international produces curriculum in order to achieve us to be some of the best trained workers in the United States. And we've been doing that for many, many, many years, and we're still on top of all that.
And I know your union is a member of the Blue-Green Alliance, along with Sierra Club and steel workers, and I think communications workers.
Mm-hmm.
So how are you and the Sierra Club working together on these issues?
We try to work hand in hand. I know when our building was built, my business manager, David Zimmerman, and John worked quite a bit on things to achieve, getting input. Dave sits on quite a few boards, and we just see a need. You know, we got the nuclear power plant. You know, that was another thing that, you know, nobody talks a lot about anymore, that we no longer, you know, but lost out there trying to get another one put up there, and that didn't work out right either. We had a lot of man hours in the one that was built up in outside of Williamsburg.
Mm-hmm. And we're just about out of time, Steve.
Oh, so okay, I'm sorry.
No, not your fault. We're going to have to move on. But I want to thank you, Steve Sneed from Sheet Metal Workers Local 36, and John Hickey from the Sierra Club for enlightening us on all of this, and keep us posted on what people can do in order to advance this energy efficiency agenda. Thanks so much, and everybody stay tuned for Auto Workers talking about the contract.
The Trans-Pacific Partnership expanding corporate rights.
The danger of false optimism in battling climate change.
UncokingMyCampus.org exposes the Koch brothers' funding of academia.
All that in a summary of this week's underreported news.
On Between the Lines.
Friday morning at 9.
Tune in to Never Again War, The Sacrifice of Kata Kulvitz, an original audio drama that commemorates the centennial of World War I and its many veterans. Hosted by Marcia Mason.
On the next Thursday night special at 7 p.m.
Oh, yeah. Swing low, sweet chariot, coming for to carry me home. Swing low, oh, oh, sweet chariot, coming for to carry me home.
Good evening and welcome back to the Heartland Labor Forum. I'm Tino Scalisi. So what do you get when you put two Italian plumbers, an Irishman from New Jersey, and a former fast food franchisee all in the same room? The next panel discussion on the proposed agreement between the United Auto Workers Union and the Ford Motor Company. Joining us in the studio is Jay Giovanelli. Jay, say hi.
How you doing?
Angela Mativi.
Hello.
Don Cattell.
How you doing?
And Joshua Crawford.
Hey, how's it going?
And these are all members from the United Auto Workers Union, Local 249, and workers at the Kansas City Assembly Plant. Let me just give you some background for those of you who don't know. Following the auto and financial crisis of 2008, auto workers across the nation were asked to accept draconian cuts, both to wages and benefits, including the infamous, quote, two-tier pay scheme, to keep the company solvent. Newly hired workers under the 2011 agreement would earn a little over half the wages of traditional senior workers performing the same work, would receive no pension, with reduced health benefits. And let's fast forward. Those same firms are now reporting record profits. Just 5 short years ago, Ford Motor Company, the best positioned of the three, earned a net profit of $6.6 billion. It reduced its debt from $33.6 billion to $14.5 billion. In the United States alone, the F-Series truck, which is built at the Kansas City Assembly Plant, was the best-selling vehicle in 2010. 528,349 units sold, or one out of every four vehicles. And in that same year, sales of cars and light trucks jumped 17% for a total of 4.6 million. In 2014, Ford reported a net income after operating costs of $3.187 billion. Not long ago, Bill Ford, chairman of Ford Motor Company, made a public statement that auto workers and their union, quote, saved Ford in its darkest hour. And now that Ford has returned to profitability, workers now expect to share in the wealth that they created. A single premium F-150 truck made in Kansas City sells for more money than the cost of one assembly line worker. Two, if we're talking about the second-tier worker. Last week, a tentative agreement was reached between UAW and Ford Motor Company, and we are here to learn what the workers have to say. We don't know. Does it go far enough? We have a message to UAW members of Ford Motor Company from the UAW International. Brothers and sisters, we are extremely proud of this tentative agreement that your UAW Ford National Negotiating Committee was able to win for our members. We came to these negotiations prepared to fight for the nearly 1,200 demands submitted by UAW members at Ford. We heard your voice, and we delivered. This agreement provides significant economic gains for all members while simultaneously addressing the challenges of job security and future growth. As an organization, we recognize the importance of quality health care for our members and their families. Currently, our health care costs cost about $8 per hour for each member, and that cost is projected to rise to more than $13 per hour over the next 4 years. Your negotiating team fought hard to protect, improve, and extend high-quality health care for all members. This is a tremendous victory for in-progression workers, as they now share the same plan as traditional workers. One of the biggest challenges facing your negotiators was protecting our jobs. Ford recently announced plans to move some production to Mexico. We have learned from experience that without product and plant investment, each of our jobs are at risk, and this put a high priority on securing product and plant commitment that allows for job growth and income security throughout the life of the agreement. From an economic standpoint, we were successfully able to negotiate a wage progression plan that eliminates the tiered pay system as we know it. Under this agreement, every full-time member will have a clear path to the traditional rate of pay. In addition, traditional workers who have gone many years without a raise will see their first general wage increase in almost a decade, followed by another wage increase in 2 years. Finally, we're extremely proud of the job your committee did for UAW members in the face of hardline negotiators at the company. We know that no one has more invested in the success of the company than the workers who help create the profits. We reminded the company time and again that our members deserve to share in its success, and it was an honor to serve you at the bargaining table. And this document summarizes the tentative agreement the UAW has reached with Ford. Please take the time to review it. In solidarity, Dennis Williams, President of the International Union, and Jimmy Settles, Vice President of UAW Ford. Guys, what do you think? You had an opportunity to look over the agreement for the past 4 days. Just so everybody knows that everybody sitting here at this table is a worker at the Kansas City Assembly Plant and are all members in good standing at UAW Local 249. What do you guys think? We don't have to. There's no formal process here, so anyone just wants to jump in.
I think they can do a lot better. I think that they have got us to the point where as we came in, I'm a tier two worker, and they wanted us to fight, and we're ready to fight for our rights, being just equal to one another. And so we're not a second class citizen anymore. And it really hurts the fact that We've been a second class citizen since we started there, and we appreciate the job. And don't get me wrong, there's nothing. We do appreciate being able to afford things for our family. However, I think that this contract's definitely sold us all short.
Anybody else? By the way, and I don't know if anybody knows, Josh Crawford is a second-tier worker at the Ford Motor Company. He started about 2 years ago, isn't that right?
Yeah, a little over 2 years ago.
Anybody else?
I don't think it goes near far enough either. I think that they could have been much, much more aggressive. I think they could have got more. I really do. I think we can still get more. I don't think that we have to settle for this first offer is right, and I don't think it addresses the tier system enough, and I don't think it addresses wages for everybody enough, considering it's been over a decade since anybody there has had a raise. And I think that 8 years for somebody to reach full scale is ridiculous. I think it's way too long.
Would it, Don?
I can't fathom how people would try to push this on us and make us try to believe that they can get to top scale with the rest of us in 8 years on a four-year contract. It's just something that they leave open, and there's been instances in the past where they've put other kind of remarks and comments into the contracts where this would be negotiated next time, mm-hmm. regardless of what it is, and it just doesn't come forward. I mean, even with the FCA contract, they stated that. They say it's a misprint, but they people were arguing that they would get topped or tiered out or topped out at 25% for the tier two people, and then when they brought this contract to them, it didn't happen. So
right. Angie,
and they skipped out on retirees altogether.
How do you mean?
I mean, they don't get anything. They get $250 bonus. Am I allowed to say that?
Oh, sure.
Sure. All right, they get $250. They still have to worry about their health care. I'm going to be a retiree sooner than later. And I don't want to be overlooked.
Sure.
And they have been overlooked. They got the shaft big time.
We're looking at this new agreement, and I think that the UAW, I think that we all recognize that we had to make sacrifices, in at least that was the general consensus in 2011, that we all had to make sacrifices in order to keep the corporations competitive, because not only were they threatening to move production to Mexico or to China or to the Philippines or to Mars or whatever it is that they said they're going to move it to, but they were, fighting for their very lives, was the word. We had auto executives going to the United States Congress asking for bailouts, and just like Ford Motor, just like Bill Ford said, of the chairman of Ford Motor Company, that the UAW and its workers bailed Ford Motor Company out in its darkest hour. Angie, what?
Well, go ahead.
I was going to say the concession started way before then.
Uh-huh.
They went back. We haven't had a raise in 10 years, if not longer. I could remember sitting around the table at work and they brought this up and they're like, well, we're going to take your next couple of raises and we're going to put it in this VEBA account for the retirees, and then that VEBA has just been mismanaged from the get go. So to touch on what Angie was saying too, with the people getting screwed over. As far as your retirees and stuff like that, yeah.
What do you see happen with this VEBA? I'm a tier two worker, so it's not like it's going to apply to me at this point. Other than the fact, I want to see the older generation that gets to retire. What do you all see being a tier one worker and having the ability to retire? What do you see happen with this VEBA? Do you feel it's funded correctly? Do you feel secure in going into that? What's your thoughts on that?
I feel very insecure about it. I mean, I think it's underfunded, and I have serious reservations about what it's going to be like when it's time for me to retire. Because, as we had talked earlier, everybody that's going to be voting on contracts at that point will never have even had a pension, So why would they stick their necks out for something they've never had? And I mean, I think this contract was negotiated from this culture of weakness that we got stuck into in the dire straits of the 2008 recession when we had to give. But the union constitution says that their job is to fight for better wages and shorter hours worked. And I don't even work on the line anymore, but I remember it very well. And it sickens me that we gave up a minute of break time during the concessions. And now they couldn't even get a minute of break time back. And you're telling me this is a great deal? You couldn't get a minute back. That means a lot to somebody that's working their butt off on that line, tearing their bodies up. Not to mention, in 08, we've increased the line speed by over 20% since then. So we're building more jobs per hour. People are working harder and faster. And wages aside, which is a whole nother, you know, issue, we couldn't get a minute of break. How do you look at a company that's making $9 billion in profits that you've gave and gave and gave for years and say, but our membership doesn't deserve the minute of break that we used to have? And, you know, everything's faster, everything's harder to do, but we can't get that back.
That's a minute per hour? Is that what I'm understanding?
Yes,
a minute per hour. So, you know, we work 10-hour shift, that's 10 minutes. And 10 minutes means a lot.
Yeah.
It does mean a lot. And the funny thing is our plant is on a relief system, so it's continuously running. So they would have to pay basically a few extra people to become a relief man.
Okay.
But they still would not lose production numbers because the line would continuously be running. So whether they went back and gave everybody their minutes to go back to, you know, doing that, you know, so it's funny. That they're not losing production numbers and what goes out the door, basically.
How many units do you guys build per hour? How many do we build at Ford Motor Company? Does anyone know how many trucks we build a day per shift?
It's 70.
Close to 70.
Yeah.
Close to 70 an hour.
Yes.
And go ahead, Josh. Were you going to say something?
No, go ahead.
Maybe it wouldn't come to a surprise to a lot of people. Maybe it doesn't come to a surprise to our audience and maybe not to our members and to UAW negotiators or people around the country who are hearing this for the first time, that Ford Motor Company could be as audacious as it is at the bargaining table to actually demand a contract like this. That, you know, when our negotiators went to the table, you know, when we asked for, you know, our breaks back, that the answer was no. You know, this is the chairman of Ford Motor Company who said that the auto workers saved us in our darkest hour. They were willing to make the sacrifices necessary to make sure that Ford Motor Company is competitive for years to come. And when it comes time, when they're making over $3 billion in 2014, when it comes time to share that wealth with the workers, the answer is no, you don't get your breaks back. The answer is no, there will not be total pay equity between the newly hired workers and the traditional workers. What do you guys have to say? I mean, about...
I would like to see negotiations go onto the floor. And here's why I say that. I'd like to see them go onto the shop floor at about August. So when they're in their suit and ties, and our negotiators should be in their suit and ties, and they're sweating on the floor with all of us. And then they can see how that extra minute will play a huge role in, say, somebody that works in a body shop that has to wear this body suit to protect their arms from being cut. And then as the sweat's rolling down their forehead, then they'll understand that, hey, maybe this extra minute will save somebody's body, or somebody driving home from work that's completely exhausted because they're drained falls asleep at the wheel and dies. I mean, that it goes into so much more safety things that it's kind of almost a heartbreaking situation. So I would love to see negotiations actually happen in 100 degrees.
That would be fun. I'm not certain that's going to happen. And so I can't picture Bill Ford coming into the middle of Kansas City Assembly plant at the J3 aisle and start negotiating with auto workers. And he doesn't have to.
My question is what did our IUAW go into negotiations with, and what did they ask for?
Mm-hmm.
Did they go and ask for our minutes back? Did they go in and ask for this or ask for that? We don't know that.
Right.
I mean, it starts with putting new delegates up there in Dearborn when we have our conventions to shake and rattle the cages a little bit.
Sure. And we've got just about 1 minute. Angie, do you want to say something in the
really
next 15
do.
Seconds?
I do. Regardless of what's in this contract, when we gave those concessions, it was the understanding that when they became profitable, we would get back what we gave up. And right. We didn't get enough, nearly enough,
no.
Hardly anything, actually. And that's not right or fair for anybody.
No, we didn't get anything.
And I have one last comment from a Tier 2 worker to you guys that have kind of paved the path for us. We want to say thank you, and we will not forget your pension or your retirement. So thank you all very much.
And thank you, everybody. I wish I had more time to talk about this. We've got a lot of things to discuss. Again, Ford Motor Company, you are one audacious company to do what you're doing. And best of luck to everybody who works at the Kansas City Assembly Plant. Thanks.
Good evening. This is Ariana Echo with Remember Our Struggle. This month, we take a look at two dramatic episodes of labor history that happened in the month of November. Six mines in the Bellevue District have struck this week. I have done my best to get them back to work. Three of them are still out. A mass meeting is called for Sunday at Priester's Park. The chances are a great many more miners will come out. Situation serious. These were the panicked words of a UMW official in a wire to his superiors in the summer of 1919. Despite repeated efforts by union leadership to bring rebellious miners back to work, including fining striking miners and providing the mine operators with strike breakers, the number of wildcatting miners continued to grow throughout the latter half of 1919. When the convention was held that fall, the demands of the rank and file rose to the fore: a 30-hour work week and a 60% wage increase. This sounds extreme, but mine operators had been making a tremendous profit on coal during the war effort and were using a wartime prohibition of wage hikes known as the Lever Act to keep this profit for themselves. Despite the war having been over for almost a year, the Lever Act was still in effect until early 1920. On November 1, 1919, the deadline the convention had set for the adoption of these terms arrived. Over 400,000 UMW coal miners went on strike. The federal government was quick to respond. Attorney General Mitchell Palmer used the Lever Act to obtain a court order prohibiting the strike and froze the union's strike fund. As schools and factories shut down nationwide due to the ensuing coal shortage, troops were sent in to coal fields all over the country. President Wilson himself finally intervened and called for a 14% wage increase and the appointment of an arbitration committee. Miners reluctantly returned to work, but unrest and further strikes continued for several more years. "You are on strike against God and nature." These were the words of a judge sentencing a young woman striker for allegedly assaulting a police officer in New York City in 1909. This was during the height of the uprising of the 20,000, when thousands of young immigrant clothing workers drew a line in the sand and backed it up by walking out on their bosses. These events can largely be traced back to one woman. Clara Lemlich immigrated to the USA from Ukraine in 1909. She spoke little or no English, only Yiddish and self-taught Russian. The 19-year-old soon found work in the shirtwaist factories to help support her family by sewing the new mass-produced women's blouses. She very likely found conditions intolerable from the first day. Women were charged for the needles for their sewing machines and the electricity to run them. They worked 7 days a week, from 7 a.m. to 8 p.m., often with no lunch, all for an average $6 a week. Many women were even locked in the sewing room to prevent them from using the bathroom, because that would disrupt production. The ILGWU, the International Ladies Garment Workers Union, had been actively organizing in the industry, so bosses were trying to hamper organization by using language barriers to divide their workforce. Clara already had an understanding of labor unions and working-class struggle. Some of her self-education had come from bartering sewing and letter-writing services to neighbors in exchange for their socialist books. Clara knew exactly how to make working conditions better. She agitated. After several smaller strikes, one of which was instigated by Clara herself, a rally was called at Cooper Union on November 22nd to discuss staging a general strike. The male organizers of the ILGWU spoke, as did several guests, including the AFL-CIO president, Samuel Gompers. But as the speeches wore on, Clara became impatient. Finally, having heard enough talk, she ran to the stage and demanded the floor. In passionate Yiddish, she declared, "I have no further patience for talk, as I am one of those who feels and suffers from the things pictured. I move that we go on a general strike, now." The audience rose to their feet and cheered, then voted for a strike. 20,000 of the 32,000 shirtwaist women walked off their jobs. The uprising of the 20,000 had begun. The strike would last through February 15th of the next year.
Finally, concessions were won, including a shorter work week, making employers pay for needles and power, shop-based negotiations for wage rates, reinstatement of the strikers, and best of all, union shops. Clara would go on to a full life of activism for several causes. One of her last campaigns was to help organize the staff of the nursing home she resided in. This has been Ariana Eckel with Remember Our Struggle. If you would like to learn more about the stories featured tonight, visit our Facebook page.
The Heartland Labor Forum calendar for November 12th. Blueprints for Freedom, a play about Bayard Rustin and the 1963 Civil Rights March, through November 15th at the Copenhagen stage in HR Block building downtown, Copenhagen. Don't miss this amazing play about an important labor and civil rights leader and how to plan a mass demonstration. Monthly Workers' Rights Clinic for Victims of Wage Theft, Monday, November 16th, 5 to 8 p.m., location El Centro, 650 Minnesota Avenue, Kansas City, Kansas. Volunteers needed, preferably bilingual, Spanish to English. Rally to Protect Pensions, Thursday, November 19th, at noon at 1727 Grand. That's the Star Building. Cross Currents presents a centennial commemoration in word and song of Joe Hill, organizer, poet, songwriter, artist, hobo, revolutionary, humorist, and fellow worker by the state of Utah, November 19, 1915. Friday, November 20th, 2015, 7:30 p.m. Trailside Center, 9901 Holmes, Kansas City, Missouri. Wyandotte County, third Saturday Democratic Breakfast. Saturday, November 21st, 8:15 for breakfast, 9:15 for the program. 8123 Parallel, Kansas City, Kansas. And a thank you party for Missouri Republicans who voted right on the right to work. Wednesday, December 2nd, 5:30 to 7 p.m., CWA Local 6360, 6415 Universal Avenue, Kansas City, Missouri. Sponsored by Missouri AFL-CIO. Kansas City Jobs with Justice, 7th Annual Scrooge Holiday Party with an Attitude. Thursday, December 10th, 5 to 7 p.m. IBEW Local 124 Hall, 301 East 103rd Terrace, Kansas City, Missouri. For more info, call Kansas City J with J, 816-805-2385.
And thank you, Molly, for the calendar. You can find our calendar, our archived shows, and our upcoming shows on our webpage at heartlandlaborforum.org. Also, like us on Facebook. Next week on the Heartland Labor Forum, we'll have a show about a new job of community health worker. Thanks to tonight's engineer, Jen Zaman.
You have been listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. We are sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Our volunteers come from a wide variety of workplaces and unions. We are supported by many Kansas City area unions and the AFL-CIO. To talk back to us, to volunteer, or to let us know about news or events, call us at 816-235-1470 or go to www.heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here on 90.1 FM KKFI.